ושמחת בחגך והיית אך שמח 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 ושמחת בחגך והיית אך שמח.
Last night, my daughter Sophie, stepson Ryan, and I were huddled in our sukkah, the one in our living room. Sophie and I were playing chess, and Ryan was telling us joke after joke. His jokes are primarily of the genre we like to call bad dad. He proudly tells people that when he is midlife and balding, he will be the most popular guy in the room. The conversation eventually turned to Sukkots of past years. Sophie lamented that her favorite part of Sukkot, what we call soup in the sukkah, our annual Sukkot celebration at our shul, is not happening this year. We thought back on various years and various temporary dwellings we had managed to erect in our yard and decorated with homemade paper garlands and dried fruit strung together. Then Sophie turned to me and said, "Hey, wait, I don't remember one from the year you had the babies." Ah, the year I had the babies. She doesn't remember having a sukkah that year because, well, we didn't have one. I think that is the one year we have really not celebrated Sukkot at all, not even at our shul party. But there was a good reason for it, and that is what I want to tell you about today.
Moshivi akeret abayit, im habanim smecha, hallelujah.
I am one of those women for whom pregnancy and childbirth is easy. Getting pregnant, staying pregnant, and the whole birth are uneventful and actually very positive experiences. But I am very, very aware of my friends and family members who have not had this experience. There is nothing I did to earn this status as good birther. For any woman and men who want children desperately but are unable to have them, the topic of fertility is truly the single most painful of their lives. The emotional and psychological consequences of infertility are real. They are serious, and they are often overlooked, minimized, and ignored in society. I have friends who struggled for years, suffered through multiple miscarriages, stillbirths, fertility treatments, and eventually they had their baby. For them, while the pain and heartache was indescribable, in the end, they did have a happy ending, a child, and so they can try to believe that it was all worth it. Those are the success stories. And then there are friends who do everything they can, spend everything they have, endure this for years, and never are able to become pregnant. Sometimes they adopt. Sometimes they remain childless. Sometimes they end up with stepchildren. Sometimes they find that the children of others in their social, familial, and faith circle are their children. Sometimes they are able to accept this, and sometimes they are not. Sometimes women do not survive this emotionally, spiritually, and physically. And then there are the partners in these stories. We rarely hear from them, but I know that they suffer in silence. We often focus on the woman who is trying to get pregnant because, well, she grows the baby. But the partners, the men and women of these women, also ache for a baby. They also cry. They hold these women. They have a role in the process, in the financial strain, in the arguments with the insurance companies, who often label these procedures optional, not medically necessary. These partners are often the ones on the phone, working out a bill for something that should have been covered but was denied. They are the ones holding their partner's hand, helpless during painful procedures or devastating news that the attempt failed, or the pregnancy that seemed to have happened stopped happening. Another failed IVF attempt, another miscarriage, another decision of whether or not it is worth trying again. Psalm 113, 5 through 9. Who is like the Lord our God, the one who sits enthroned on high, who stoops down to look on the heavens and the earth? He raises the poor from the dust and lifts the needy from the ash heap. He seats them with princes, with the princes of his people. He settles the childless woman in her home as a happy mother of children. In the summer of 2016, I drove my daughter to Hawaya, the Reconstructionist summer camp in the Pocono Mountains of Pennsylvania, and then I drove up to Boston to visit some friends. They had just adopted a baby boy. When I held him, I could not believe my own children had ever been this tiny. He had a full head of black hair and was a really good sleeper. We were able to take him with us out to eat and on a sightseeing venture downtown. I was also there to visit them and discuss if we still really wanted to do this. My friends had been on the infertility journey for some time. They had tried and failed to become pregnant through IVF. They had adopted the baby, but they still had two fertilized embryos. They wanted a surrogate. They wanted me to be their surrogate. I wanted to help. I told them I would try. I also knew I was in my late 30s. My own kids were school age. We could assume I would be successful, but fertility declines in mid to late 30s for most women. I knew that this could be yet one more disappointment for them. But on that trip, it was decided. We would do this. We would give it our best shot. The next week, I spent hours on the phone with the fertility clinic. I answered what felt like 200 questions that ranged from basics like my weight and general health to the very personal, my sexual history and current behaviors, STDs, and emotional well-being. By the end of it, I was approved to come to the clinic in Denver for testing. And one sunny afternoon in October of 2016, after a full day of poking and prodding, I was approved. I could be their gestational carrier, as the clinic called me. This was going to happen. It is one thing to witness infertility from the outside, to see the Facebook post of a friend who is struggling, who has gotten her hopes up, only to be given devastating news again and again. To comment each time, hugs, because we really don't know what to say to her. But we want to let her know we are there, caring, yet unable to really do anything to help. It is quite another to be inside of it all, actually doing something to help, actually there as part of it. There is a certain pressure felt in that role. I knew that if it didn't work, I would always wonder if perhaps I had done something wrong. What if I missed an injection? What if I ate the wrong things? Didn't get enough sleep? What if I didn't get enough exercise? What if I exercised too much? Drank too much caffeine? My friends, I will call them C and B, told me we would be a team. There would be no blame, no pressure. We would do this, and if it did not work, we would still always be friends. I was like family now, in the middle of this, right in the middle of the most intimate part of their life. I was in on the pain, on the joy, on the hope, on the fear and worry and excitement. On February 14th, 2017, just a week and a half after the transfer, meaning that they put two fertilized embryos into my uterus, I found that I was completely unable to think about anything other than the possibility of being pregnant. So against the advice of the fertility clinic, I went to the pharmacy and bought a test. I knew it was unlikely to show anything. I didn't get my hopes up. I put the stick on the edge of the sink and didn't even look at the results. I walked away, assuming it would say, not pregnant. I began cooking dinner. I decided I would return later when I could muster the courage to look at the answer that would change or not change our lives. I didn't tell my friends I had done this. I didn't want to jerk them around emotionally. And I knew that as much as I was feeling right now, the anxiety, the butterflies in my stomach, the longing for this to work, the fear that it wouldn't, I knew it was nothing compared to what they were going through, waiting, waiting helplessly for my body, for the blood test we were scheduled for in a couple of days. I remember standing at the stove, stirring some food in a pan, when my daughter Felicity walked into the room with the test. "So it worked," she said nonchalantly. I looked at her. I looked at the test. Slowly, I reached out my hand and took it from her. The words were there, clear. My stomach dropped. I could feel the butterflies rising into my throat. I sat down at the table, my hands trembling. The words in purple letters read, "Pregnant." "So it worked," she repeated. Oh wow. Oh wow, it did," I said. I sat there unsure what to do. Should I tell them? Should I call them with the news? Would they want me to? Would they want me to get their hopes up? But what if B had been able to get pregnant? She would have done a test, I was sure of it. She would have had this moment. So I called. C answered the phone. "I have some news. I bought a test at the pharmacy," and he was silent on the other end. "Just tell me yes or no." I could hear the fear in his voice, the expectation of news that, again, as it had always been, being negative, a disappointment, again, failure, again, heartbreak, again. "Yes," I told him. "It's a yes. It's positive." The phone clicked off. He had hung up on me accidentally. When he called back a minute later, B was also on the phone. I could hear her voice shaking with excitement, with emotion, with tears. We all knew the next test, the blood test, would tell us if it was really a viable pregnancy. But for now, as far as we knew, we were pregnant. We. Them and me. The 8 months or so that followed were crazy. Fun, exciting, exhausting. I went for my first ultrasound and was pregnant with not one, not two, but three babies. That was a shock. But then by 12 weeks, one of them had stopped growing. Now it was two. Two babies. They were boys. Fraternal. C and B traveled every month for my appointments, for the ultrasounds. My now husband, Jim, was also along for the ride, but when we started all of this, he and I had just started dating. By the time I was full term, we had bought a house. He was able to care for me as I reached term with the twins. Sukkot came just as I reached 38 weeks.
Hallelujah. 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 Hallelujah.
I think this year we'll just use the sukkah at the shul, and we can also eat outside under the maple tree, I told my family. My husband agreed. We knew that the babies would come any day. We knew C and B would be flying to our house at the drop of a hat. We knew that building a sukkah was probably not going to happen, and it was fine. And that is just what happened. On the second day of Sukkot, October 6th, 2017, I was admitted to the hospital. I was in labor, but since baby A was breech, they needed to do a C-section. My contractions got serious quickly, showing up large and long on the monitor. C and B were there in the room, along with my husband, when the doctor checked my progress and said to the nurse, "We need to do this now." Someone threw scrubs at my husband, who was the only one allowed into the operating room with me. B told me later that as she and C walked into the waiting room, my husband called out to them, "This is it. This is the moment we have all been working so hard for." Baby A came out, chubby and howling, almost 8 pounds. Then baby B, even louder than his brother, at just under 7 pounds. "Wow, those are big, healthy babies," the doctor told me, as he released the NICU staff who had been standing by just in case they were needed. People often ask me if it was hard giving the babies to their parents. I always answer the same way. Those babies were never mine to keep. I always knew that. I loved them as their surrogate mom. But no, I never had any desire to keep them. And it is true. I was too overjoyed for C and B to ever consider that I might be sad to give them over to them. Today I received a huge vase of fresh flowers from the boys. They are 3 today. C and B sent pictures with the flowers, cute, healthy, rambunctious boys posing alongside their 4-year-old brother, the 3 amigos. Every year on this day, I am reminded of the joy of this season, that so often the greatest joy in our life comes from giving of ourselves to others, from truly being compassionate and generous, and doing whatever we can to make a difference in the lives of people who need us. You don't have to give birth for someone. I know that is a pretty extreme example, but to acknowledge that others need your presence, or a note in the mail reminding them that they are seen and held in their pain or loneliness or fear. I marvel at how this experience changed me, that I received so much blessing through it. Through it, I know what it is to ache for a child, to work so hard for something that others take for granted. To hold the pain and grief of others, to sit with them, to take it on as my own, to give of myself for the good of another. I know what our world could look like if we all lived this way, if we offered what we could when we are able, if we would stand up and say, "I know this isn't my problem, but I can help," and then we do it. No strings attached, no expectations of compensation or commendation, to remember that God works through us to heal the world. We are therefore partners with God in the plan for healing, redemption, for all of the goodness that can be in the world. As Psalm 113 says, "God raises the poor from the dust and lifts the needy from the ash heap. God settles the childless woman in her home as a happy mother of children." God expects that tikkun, healing and repair, comes through us, from our gifts to one another, from our mitzvot, our deeds, from the riches we have received. We are given the blessing of serving those who God connects to us in our life journey. And so this Sukkot, my prayer for all of us, is that we will be open to the opportunities God gives us to make a difference in the lives of others. To stand up and say, "I can help, hineni." To be generous of heart and mind and spirit, and to wait for the joy that will come from it. B'samachta b'chagecha v'hayita ach sameach. and happy birthday to my special boys.
Ve'samachta b'chagecha v'hayita ach sameach. 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 Ve'samachta b'chagecha v'hayita ach sameach.